You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcast on commercial stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across North America, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, simulcast as TV on both Dish Network and DirecTV. More people watching or listening to the Tom Hartman Program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive radio show in the world. 3 years running, 9 years into the show. Greetings. Welcome back from Labor Day. Our telephone number, 866-987-THOM. Our website, of course, tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. Over there, you'll find our daily stack. Sue puts together every day everything that we've talked about throughout the day. And as well, all you know, our free app and all kinds of other stuff. Twitter and Facebook, Tom_Hartman. On the line with us, the president of the general president, more official title, of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, teamster.org, the website, Mr. James Hoffa. James Hoffa, welcome back to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom. How are you?
Just great. I should add, your Twitter address is Teamster Power. Or at Teamster Power. It's great to have you with us. I was, frankly, inspired by your comments leading up to President Obama's Labor Day speech in Detroit, my old hometown. I was born in Michigan. I lived in Detroit for some time on a couple of different occasions in my life. And most of my, until I was 27, I lived in Michigan. And I'm just curious your thoughts on, A, what you said, and, B, the response to it. It seems like Fox News and Drudge are near hysteria.
Well, that's the right wing, but, you know, what I'm hearing is from working families, people say, hey, finally somebody's saying it, calling these people out. Our lines at the Union Hall are ringing off the hook of people saying, by God, keep it up. We've got to define the issues here. And what I said was that we basically all have a vote. We've got to get together. We are a mighty army. And we, if we all get together, we can take back America from these Tea Party people, and we'll do it in November of 12. That's what I said. And, you know, if that got everybody upset, I don't know how that does. It's talking about democracy, about getting together and getting our workers fired up, and that's what we're doing. There is a war on workers, and that's what I did talk about. And the fact is that the right wing, you know, the Tea Party has declared war on Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, you name it, they're out there. They propose right to work in 14 states simultaneously.
This is so right to work for less, actually.
Right to work for less, which the president, by the way, talked on.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm against the right to work for less. He also embraced collective bargaining for all people who have joined a union. So he said the right things yesterday, and he had a very inspirational speech. So we had a great time yesterday. I did my part to try and inspire the crowd. But there is a war on workers, and you know, anybody that doesn't know about the war, I mean, they started the war. And I'm saying, okay, there's going to be a loser and a winner, and we're going to be the winners. They got the money. We got the votes.
Well, and in fact, over the roughly the same time that you were making your comments, the Koch brothers were holding a meeting of millionaires and billionaires, and Charles Koch, if this recording is to be believed, and I think we have it from a fairly credible source. This is an article over in Mother Jones magazine, and the audio is from Mother Jones. Here's what he said.
Because Saddam Hussein, this is the mother of all wars.
He said, this guy, I'll just cut it right there. He said, this guy is Saddam Hussein, this is the mother of all wars. And then he went on to praise 23 people who had devoted each over $1 million to the process of this basically right-wing war against working-class Americans, and specifically against the leader of the Democratic Party, President Obama.
Well, you know, Mitch McConnell, the senator from Kentucky, has said, hey, it's my job. We're going to make him a one-term president. He's basically saying, I'm going to take Obama out. Mm. And they're doing it by these tactics of obstructing him. Not only are they attacking, you know, working men in, you know, Wisconsin, everywhere you could look, in Ohio, but also they're doing everything they can to obstruct any effort to turn this country around. We saw that with the debt ceiling debate where they were completely unreasonable. You know, I keep saying that, you know, the president tries to be reasonable with people that are unreasonable, you know, that have signed these different pledges not to raise taxes. You know, we don't, no one likes taxes, but we can certainly have more revenue. We have, you know, 20 major corporations that don't pay any taxes. Isn't it time that they started paying taxes? I pay taxes. We've got hedge funds people that are paying 15%, and they're millionaires and billionaires, and my members pay 30% or better. So, you know, let's make it fair, and I think that's all people are asking for. We've got to cut through this rhetoric and really say, you know, what's going on here? Why do they obstruct the president so much? You know, why are they trying to take away collective bargaining everywhere they can look, you know, whether it's Ohio or Wisconsin? So you really see what the war is, and it is going on right now, and we're fighting that war, and we think we're winning.
Just to put a an end to this, or to wrap this up, this piece of this, President Obama has called out strong rhetoric. In fact, he did several years ago. Joe Scarborough made a big deal about it this morning on TV, and said, you know, it's not useful on either side. It seems to me, though, that not to attack or defend anybody's rhetoric on any side. I mean, from Sarah Palin's time to lock and reload to your let's take them out. And I'm assuming, by the way, just for clarification, I'm assuming you meant that in an entirely political context.
If you look at my speech, I said everybody here has a vote. Let's get together. We are a mighty army, and we will vote in November 12th. That's what the quote is.
Yeah. Okay.
Vote.
Right. And so I'm just curious where you think this is going to go politically over the next 14 months. It seems that pretty much no matter what President Obama offers, I mean, even routine things that have never been controversial before, raise the debt ceiling, for example, fund the Federal Aviation Administration, have all of a sudden become hostage-taking operations for the Republican Party. Is it your opinion that we can expect to see 14 months of absolute paralysis and probably a replay of the Harry Truman playbook where the president is running against a do-nothing Congress? We have about a minute left, sir.
Well, I think that's exactly where we're going. Things aren't going to get better. They're going to get worse. We had a hostage-taking with the unemployment bill. We had a hostage-taking with raising the debt ceiling. Like you said, we had one with the FAA. We're going to have one over the highway bill. They're going to just keep this up all the way to the election. And then they're going to say, see, we got nothing done, when they're the ones obstructing it. So it's relatively easy to see what's going to happen. I think the president eventually has to go over their heads. He has to propose reasonable solutions to problems and then say, okay, I have done my best. I have sat with you. I have tried to reason. I can't get it done. And then let's have an election to say, okay, let's make sure we understand what the things are. They want to obstruct. I want to get America moving again. I think that's a debate we have, and I think we'll win in the election in November.
Yeah, and this could be the sweep of 2012. I mean, it's not inconceivable that this could be an extension of the change election, assuming people get sufficiently upset. I think they're getting there, and I think you've captured the zeitgeist of the moment. James Hoffa, the general president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, teamster.org, the website, Twitter, @TeamsterPower. James Hoffa, thank you so much for being with us, President Hoffa.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I gotta share with you my take on what's going on with this, because it's a little nuanced, and I think it's really, really important. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I told you I wanted to share with you a nuanced take on this. I think it's on this whole, you know, on Labor Day, on the whole issue of labor and what's going on in America right now, and that is that it's not just going on right now. In the United Kingdom, in Spain, in Italy, in Greece, you saw governments taken down by banksters. Goldman Sachs and other big American banks, and in some cases some large European banks, sold to the pension funds of some of these European countries or did other, you know, shady deals. So Matt Taibbi's done a great job of documenting all this stuff over Rolling Stone and his book Griftopia. I need not go into all the details, but the bottom line is basically the banksters, you know, burned these countries. Now, so far, Iceland is the only one of the EU countries that has said, you know, we're not going to pay back the banksters. It would have been about $6,000 per person in Iceland. An addition of $545 per year to their taxes for about a decade. And basically, they just, you know, to pay back, to make the banks whole, as it were, out of public funds. And the Icelandic people, being probably closer to a democracy than pretty much anything else we have floating around, said in two different referendums, no and hell no. And they're doing just fine, thank you very much. But in the other European countries, when they decided to pay back the banksters, the governments then, because government funds were used to pay the banks for the money that they lost gambling. Right. The banks lose money gambling, so state funds, federal funds, are used to make them whole so that the banksters could continue to take their huge profits, put it in their pocket, and walk off, and which leaves the governments in a pinch. Right? I mean, not only did the banksters crash the economy, which means that economic activity is down, tax collection is down, unemployment is up, where people used to be paying money into the government in the form of taxes, now they're taking money from the government in the form of unemployment compensation, things like that. So, you know, not only is it hurting the government, but what's happening is that people are, you know, their expectations are just being wiped out. These massive expectations are being wiped out. People expected to have a good job, the equivalent of Social Security, a good health benefits and things like that. And governments, several of these governments, particularly in Spain and in Greece and in Portugal, in those countries that were really, really badly hit. Keep in mind, the only one of these countries that was running a deficit was Greece before the banksters hit them. They were all running, you know, more or less balanced budgets or surpluses. Greece had a rather significant deficit that Goldman Sachs helped them hide. Again, Matt Taibbi laid that whole thing out in his piece in Rolling Stone. He's been on this program twice to explain it. So there was this sudden change in, for example, England. You know, they cut federal spending so radically that in 6 months, GDP dropped by a half a point and unemployment went up by a point. I mean, just like that, the government just started laying off people like crazy. And, you know, it hurt their economy very quickly. So they're going, a few of these countries are flirting with the edge of going from a social contract between the government and the people that says, if you, you know, graduate from school and do your, you know, and work hard and keep your nose clean, you will be able to buy a home and a car and or have transportation and have a decent retirement and health care, and have a social safety net. That's the deal that we made after World War II, arguably before World War II, the New Deal. But it really took incarnation after World War II here in the United States. That's the deal that the government made with Americans, is graduate from high school at the least, get a job, we'll make sure you get a decent pay, you can raise a family, put your kids through school, retire with a pension, have decent price health care, because in every state in the union it was required that it was not for profit. And then along came Ronald Reagan. And it wasn't just Reagan. I mean, this really began about 2 years before Reagan. in a big way. But and the thinking on this began in the 60s. It was laid down explicitly in 1974 by Lewis Powell in a memo to his friend, the president of the Chamber of Commerce. But basically what it was the conservatives said, we need to change that social contract, that compact between the government and the people, from one that is, in their mind, socialist, that says that the government will be there, will backstop you, and will make sure that you have a decent standard of living if you're a good citizen. We need to change that to one where the government basically says, we're going to look out for the interests of the wealthy, we're going to look out for the interests of the corporations, and working people, you're on your own. Forget about Medicare. Forget about Social Security. Forget about Medicaid. Forget about social. Forget about unemployment insurance. All those things. Oh, those are nice, but you know we can't afford those anymore because our billionaires have doubled their wealth in the last 12 years, and that money's got to come from somewhere, buddy. It's coming from you. That's the new social contract. And the thing is, it took 30 years of gradual incremental change in the United States. So we're like the frog in the slowly heating pot. To the point where now Paul Ryan comes right out and says, here's a piece of legislation that says we're going to privatize Medicare. And all but three members of the House of Representatives, Republicans in the House of Representatives, vote for it and intend to run on it. So what we're seeing is not just a war, to use James Hoffa's metaphor. What we're seeing is a fundamental change.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And that fundamental change is one that's going to echo for generations if these guys are successful and take us back to neo-feudalism.
They say the next big thing is that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Exposing the con and conservative, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Ken in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Ken. How you doing?
Hey, Tom. I want to thank you for having Mr. Hoff on today. It was a great interview.
Thank you.
And,
thank him.
I agree with everything he had to say, and I just want to add that we here in Detroit, the arsenal of democracy, we're willing to fight this war. I mean, it's too important. We're never going to wave a white flag with these daggers ever.
You know, in 1936, when Franklin Roosevelt was running for his second term as president and had just been nominated in Philadelphia in July of 1936, he ended his speech by saying, I have signed up for the war. I am here for the duration. And he was not talking about Germany. This was long before Germany, Germany didn't invade Poland until 39. This was 1936. The war he was talking about was the war against the Great Depression and the war against the people who had brought us the Great Depression and wanted to take us back into it, which was the Republican Party. And for James Hoffa to use that kind of rhetoric, I think, is not only entirely appropriate, but consistent with a long history of American political rhetoric. And, typically not so often by politicians, but he's not a politician. He's a labor leader. And to call these guys SOBs, I think that's the main thing that Fox is all hysterical about, seems to me not inappropriate.
Well, the fascist right, the theocracy, and all that's going on the right wing is just, it's put a lot of people over the edge in this part of the country anyway, where unemployment's so high. And we've got a governor in this state who's,
he's taking apart your state.
So quick to come down on the labor unions because he knows a lot of labor unions are voting in the state.
Yep.
But you look at Ohio and they've got 1.3 million votes against Mr. Kasich on the Prop 5 bill.
Yep.
And it's got him running scared.
Yep.
And I think Mr. Walker's running scared as well.
Yep. And Rick Scott down in Florida doesn't. He's not. So far, he's got he's not facing the possibility of a recall because of the way the laws are organized in Florida, but his popularity ratings are worse than any of the rest of them. Ken, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Will in Stanwood. Hey, Will, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Well, I was going for a bike ride on Labor Day, and I came up with this thought of let's have Corporation Day. Mm-hmm. The right has gone to the extremes of taking the labor movement away from us, and they're trying to build the corporations up. So let's have Corporation Day. And August doesn't have a vacation anyway, so they could sponsor a day of a holiday, and they could bid it out like they do for Comquest Field or Quest Field or whatever, and whoever is the highest bidder pays for the holiday for everybody in America to take a day.
I can see the float going down, Fifth Avenue with all these guys in suits and vests with gold chains and gold pocket watches and monocles and.
Precise. I mean, like ExxonMobil doesn't pay any taxes, so here's a good way for them to pay back to the American public all the money they've stole from us.
Right, right. It's pretty remarkable. You may be onto something. Thanks a lot for the call, Will. I appreciate it. Jackie in Silverdale. Hey, Jackie, what's up?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling in about the Warren workers. There is a company in Moorhead, Minnesota, by the name of American Crystal Sugar Company.
Mm-hmm.
They are the largest sugar producer in the United States. They were negotiating with the union. The union rejected the contract by 96%. And they showed up for work on August 1st, and the company has locked them out since that date. And they have only met with them once to discuss a new contract. And the reason they rejected the contract was due to the language in it regarding job security. And this one, it's just, I used to work there. That's why I'm really interested in it. And my brother-in-law also works there.
Yeah. What you're seeing, Jackie, is this, and this is happening all across the United States, what we're seeing is this fundamental change in the relationship between workers, between the working class and the, you know, the elite wealthy class, and which side government comes down on. Government has historically in the United States, with a few exceptions, the robber baron era, the Gilded Age, the 1880s, and the Roaring Twenties, but with few exceptions, the government has basically come down on the side of the working people. It has, you know, we the people, the first three words of the Constitution. The whole point of creating a government was to say, you know, we're here for the people. And this change began when Ronald Reagan came along and said, government is not the problem, government is the solution. Government is not the solution, government is the problem. And what he was really saying was government advocacy for the rights of people rather than corporations is the problem. It's getting in the way. Well, in fact, here's Ronald Reagan saying it.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
And, you know, there you go. And so, you know, he's just, we're going to have smaller government. We're going to get government out of the way. We're going to have fewer regulations. These are all code words for saying we're going to allow those instruments and institutions of great power, the large corporations and the millionaires and billionaires, we're going to allow those institutions of great power to take power, control power, and have power. And those institutions of little power, that is the working people, we're no longer there to protect. And I think that, frankly, if the president doesn't very quickly, and tomorrow's the day that he's supposed to do this, or day after tomorrow, actually, doesn't come out and say, you know, maybe in a coded way, but essentially in a way that Americans get, that we are now here for you, then the Democratic Party's in trouble, he's in trouble, and frankly, the future of the working class in America is in trouble. So I see that as the Jackie, thank you for the call. I see that as the big problem. And, you know, on top of that, you've got, I mean, here, this is clip four. This is Dick Cheney. You've got, well, actually, let's go to Michelle Bachmann, clip number five. Now, her campaign is imploding rapidly. I mean, to say it's imploding rapidly, in fact, would be an overstatement. Her staff people, her top two staff people, if my understanding of the news that I read this morning is correct, are leaving. And, you know, people get it, that Rick Perry is going to out Michelle Bachmann, and, you know, she's become kind of the fringe candidate. But nonetheless, here she is talking about, we could reinvent the tax code so that corporations don't have to pay taxes.
Would you go as far as, say, our Palin and eliminate all corporate income taxes?
We could go that route. If we went that route, then we'd have to have a fundamental restructuring of the tax code. I'm open to having that debate, and as a former federal tax lawyer, I've dealt with whether it's a national consumption tax, a flat tax, or some variation on the current system.
So you could see by making other adjustments a way to eliminate corporate taxes.
It would be possible if we have a fundamental restructuring of the tax code.
Yeah. So we get rid of the taxes on the really and truly wealthy people in the United States and on the corporations. Oh, yeah, they're using the resources of the commons. They're using, but, you know, nah, we don't need to charge them for it. They can have it for free. The workers will pay for it with their income taxes, things like fire protection and police protection and the roads and the highways and the throughways on which the telephone lines run and the internet lines run and the cell towers are located and everything. We'll take care of, you know, the bandwidth and all that. We'll pay for that. You know, we the little people, as Leona Helmsley famously said, you know, it's only the little people who pay the taxes. And then on top of that, we've got people like Dick Cheney running around going, war criminal? Clip four, Jacob.
Anything you want to take back?
No.
Powell's former chief of staff, Lawrence Wilkerson, I don't know if you know this, has also weighed in. He says that you're worried about being tried as a war criminal.
Well, that's news to me. I know he speaks out from time to time, and that strikes me as a cheap shot.
Your head's not going to explode.
No.
Okay. Yeah, that's very funny. You know, it lied us into a couple of wars, you know, led to a couple hundred thousand deaths, millions of refugees, destroyed millions and millions of families, cost this country $3 trillion, destroyed our reputation around the world, tortured people, which led to an explosion in sympathy for the jihadis in the Muslim world. But hey, it's good for a laugh. He's laughing because he knows he's not going to be prosecuted. Another tragedy. 45 minutes past the hour. Back with your thoughts on this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Oh, and the post office. Can you believe this? The war on the post office. I got to tell you about this right after the break. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so. Ain't happening. FDR, 1936. One of his comments that wouldn't it be nice to hear echoed day after tomorrow?
Of course we will continue to seek to improve working conditions for the workers of America. To reduce hours that are overlong. To increase wages that spell starvation. To end the labor of children and to wipe out sweatshops. Of course, We will continue every effort to end monopoly in business to support collective bargaining.
This is strong stuff.
To stop unfair competition and to abolish dishonorable trade practices.
Wow.
And for all these, we have only just begun to fight.
We have only just begun to fight. And they think James Hoffa is tough in his language. I mean, come on. Amazing. Barbara and Everett. Hey, Barbara, what's up?
I was wondering, why is the union not put on the end of the Chamber of Commerce? Because that's what it is. It's a union for the rich.
Well, it's a good question. It first of all, it's not there to protect working people. Secondly, it's not a true democracy where every person who is a participant has an equal vote. It really doesn't operate as a union. Unions are democratic institutions. The Chamber of Commerce is not. So it's a lobbying It's a lobbying institution. It's a business, basically. Perhaps a nonprofit business. I'm not sure, but
it's a business, true, but it's a business that is collective.
Yes, and it represents the interests of its members. But to call it a union, I think, would diminish the good name of unions. I don't know how to put it beyond that.
Hey, I agree, but as long as they're coming down on the unions, why not give them a name?
I see. Okay, yeah, if you're going to come down on unions. Well, because they're not really coming down on unions. They're coming down on working people, and the unions happen to represent working people, and that's what they're so offended by, is, you know, how could we have any institution that defends working people? How could we have an institution where, you know, you got to pay dues into this thing? Holy cow, and those dues might be used to get better working conditions and to have representation. We want one employee to have to deal with one employer, even though that one employer is a $1 billion corporation, that one employee has $400 in the bank. That's equal. You know, that's how it should be. This is the conservative worldview. This is the Koch brothers worldview. This is pretty unabashed about it. I mean, you know, they're not going anywhere beyond that. They're just laying it right out for you.
I agree with you, but the chamber also pays in dues.
Yeah.
They work very much like a union.
Well, it used to be the local chambers of commerce did. The local chambers of commerce, back in the day when local chambers of commerce, you know, pre-70s basically, when local chambers of commerce were, you know, local small business, largely men's groups, I used to have a business back in the 70s. We were a member of the chamber, you know, of the Chamber of Commerce in Lansing, Michigan. Yeah, and it was a whole different thing. But what we have now is basically, you know, a lobbying institution that operates on behalf of transnational corporations and billionaires, and they're not interested in small companies.
I agree, but also the unions lobby. But why not, if they're so dead set against unions, why not call them unions?
Yeah, okay. Barbara, you made your point. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Fred in Detroit. Hey, Fred, what's up?
Well, I got to tell you something. I've been wondering why in the world we cannot sue CEOs and other corporate owners, since they are now people. Can they no longer be shielded for personal losses in the performance of their duties?
They are super people. LLC stands for Limited Liability Corporation. They are super people.
LLCs, PCs.
Yeah.
But if corporations are now people, should they be shielded?
No. Here's what the Supreme Court actually decided in Citizens United. They did not literally decide that corporations have the full rights of citizenship and personhood that human beings do. And in fact, we're going to get into this in a lot more detail in the next hour when Tom Lindsay comes by. But if you go in and you read that decision, and read the decision and then read the dissent, and the whole thing is a little over 120 pages, but it's actually worth reading, and it's not all that super technical. What you get is that the argument that the five justices, the five conservatives who prevailed over the four who opposed it, that the majority prevailed on, their argument was not that corporations have a right to speak because they're persons. Their principal argument was that corporations are the largest economic players in America. Therefore, they have the most information about the economy and about things of importance in America. And therefore, you and I as citizens would be harmed if we were deprived of the ability to hear on an unfettered, unregulated basis whatever those corporations want to say. So it wasn't so much their right to speak that was endorsed. It was our right to hear. Now, if we're going to have a right to hear corporations on an unlimited basis, then they have a right, have to have a right to speak on an unlimited basis. And that's the way they constructed that. Now, the dissenters said, come on, guys, we know what you're really saying and what you're really doing here. And you're basically giving corporations First Amendment rights through the back door. And that's exactly what was going on. But it was through the back door, Fred. Fred, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back with Tom Lindsay of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. In our first hour, we had James Hoffa, the general president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, on, pointing out that Fox News took him out of context. Gee, what a surprise. And that he was calling on people to vote. Anyhow, we will get back to that conversation in a few minutes. But hang on just a second here. But in the meantime, the Koch brothers got together, and they, you know, apparently Charles Koch says basically that that President Obama is Saddam Hussein and that this is all-out war, and there's, like, serious stuff going on here. I mean, the corporate powers that be are taking things on. So how do we push back against these corporations? And apropos of the caller in the last hour who said, well, you know, didn't the Supreme Court say corporations were people and citizens united? And I said, well, not so much. They said that we have the right to listen to them. It was an interesting framing of that. But let's ask a guy who really knows. Tom Lindsay is the executive director and co-founder of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. He's also the chief legal counsel. He's an attorney. He's been fighting this fight since the very early days, one of the best guys on the topic. CELDEF, C-E-L-D-F, as in Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, .org is the website. The Twitter is at CELDEF, C-E-L-D-F. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Tom, thanks for having us.
Thanks for being back with us. What are you guys up to? What's happening out there in this movement to push back on so-called corporate personhood?
Well, it's a movement that's spreading across the United States at this point, and it basically the folks that are bearing the brunt of decisions like Citizens United and this concept of corporate constitutional rights are local communities that are attempting to do things like stop fracking in their municipality. This practice of jamming large amounts of water and toxic chemicals into the ground to extract natural gas from communities above the shale formations in the Northeast. That these communities are not able to say no to these activities under the current structure of law. And one of the reasons for that is that corporations have more rights than the communities in which they operate. And so right now, this movement dealing with corporate rights is really grounded in local communities, where communities don't want certain things to take place. Could be the Keystone XL pipeline that TransCanada is trying to lay down to Texas. Could be fracking, could be land development, could be Walmart. Depending on what the community doesn't want in their community because it's not sustainable for them, that these folks are on the front lines of saying no. And when they say no to these things coming in, they run up frontally up against this thing called corporate rights, which is this concept, of course, that corporations have the same constitutional rights as you or I, and by virtue of the wealth that they harbor, actually have greater constitutional rights than the communities in which they do business.
And so how does a community fight back?
Well, communities are fighting back by breaking the law, something that's fundamental to all people's movements in the United States. whether it be the abolitionists who helped escaping slaves, northern juries in the North who refused to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act, the suffragists who attempted to cast ballots for presidential elections, all in violation of the law. And today in the United States, it's a weird thing to say sometimes, but sustainability is illegal. It's been rendered illegal by the system of law, because when we attempt to do pursue sustainability, especially at the local level, what we run into is a box of corporate rights that actually prohibit or prevent us from moving that direction. And so in a very strange way in these United States, sustainability itself is illegal. And when we toss around the phrase corporate rights, a lot of people think that's an abstract concept, that corporations have constitutional rights. What's happening right now on the front edges of this movement across the United States is communities standing up to say to corporations, you don't have rights in these communities. So, for example, last year in November of 2010, the city of Pittsburgh became the first major municipality in the United States to refuse to recognize that natural gas corporations had certain constitutional rights within their municipality. Now, to some folks, corporate rights seem abstract. To the people in the city of Pittsburgh, it's not. Because for them to actually exercise their right, what they feel is their right to say no to gas fracking within the city of Pittsburgh, they have to go one step forward further and actually dismantle the structure of corporate rights that has been put in place for the last 100 years in the United States. So it's an evolution of thinking by folks at the local level who, to be honest, have given up hope that the federal government is going to step in to save them, have given up hope that the state government is going to step in to save them. And instead, they're beginning to do something fundamental at the local level to actually change the structure of law that's been imposed upon them that enables the corporations to do what they do within those individual communities.
So it seems that there's two different things going on that both point in the same direction. And you know, clarify this for me, or maybe they're the same thing concurrently. On the one hand, you've got the movetoamend.org coalition, basically, that's saying, let's amend the Supreme Court, because all of these corporate rights that you're describing, or the vast majority of them, were not the result of legislatures or presidents saying, gee, let's give rights to corporations. They were the result of Supreme Court decisions. So, you know, move to amend the Constitution to say corporations are not persons, money is not speech. And then on the other hand, the work that you're doing and many others, but you've been spearheading this now for at least a decade, it seems, that I've known you. Correct me how long it has been. But in any case, that working with local communities to say, no, we're going to defy those laws that are based on those Supreme Court decisions. And confront.
Yeah, and the two are somewhat interlinked. The only problem is that there's an existing understanding, it seems, almost a myth within the liberal progressive community, that we just need to find the right case to then go up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court justices will smack themselves on the forehead and say, of course, for 100 years we've been wrong and we're going to reverse this.
Yeah, that ain't going to happen.
That's not going to happen. And a constitutional amendment, if we agree with the concept that the Constitution must be changed, which our organization does, in fact, we think a rewrite of some of the constitutional text is probably necessary to get rid of things like the Commerce Clause, or at least to scale it back, and to take care of other issues, because in some ways the constitutional construct puts the rights of property and commerce above the rights of people, communities, and nature. That, in essence, it's not going to happen just from communities passing non-binding resolutions within the localities. That's a misreading of how things change within the United States. Things change within the United States through true movements which actually frontally challenge the law that's existing in place.
Right.
That's what movements do. And so it all goes hand in hand. Eventually, we do end up at constitutional change. But the model that the Pittsburgh folks are working under and the 120 other communities in Maine and Virginia and Maryland and Pennsylvania and these communities in these other states that have been passing these local laws, which essentially openly confront and challenge this concept of corporate rights, that those folks all have a commonality, which is eventually the local has to become the state and the state has to become the federal.
Right.
What folks are doing right now is modeling or blueprinting a new structure of law which makes sustainability legal within their municipalities, with an understanding that change has to be driven up to the state level. So just last year, over 35 communities in Pennsylvania came together to talk about what state constitutional change would look like. And eventually that state constitutional change has to morph upwards to the federal, to federal change. But to think that anything's going to happen because we beg and plead our federal elected officials or state officials to do something, I think is a misreading of this country's history. Right. It only changes when people refuse to live under a structure of law that guarantees that they get the shaft. And whether you're in a community that's on the receiving end of a Walmart, a big box store, mining, fracking, you name the one of thousands of different projects that communities are faced with every day, that until folks begin to understand that they're being channeled in some ways like cattle down a chute by a permit and appeal system that's essentially been put in place by the same corporations it's ostensibly supposed to regulate, we're always going to be on the defensive. And this movement, as it has to build, has to go on the offense. And the only way you go on the offense is to have communities laying their collective bodies down on the line, such as the folks in Pittsburgh did unanimously through their city council.
Thomas, stick around for just a second, please.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We're talking with Thomas Lindsay, the executive director and co-founder of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund and their chief counsel, CELDF.org. Welcome back to your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. Thomas Lindsay is with us. He's the executive director and co-founder of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF, CELDF.org. The website was just telling us how basically communities have to become criminals, have to become lawbreakers by passing their own laws that basically violate what has become over 100 years of American history. Property law as a consequence of both the way the Constitution was constructed and a series of Supreme Court decisions dating back to the early days. Do I have that right, Thomas, so far?
Yeah, although I think it's a calling to a higher law. And that higher law is this innate sense, this innate right to community local self-government. And the base of that understanding is that if we're ever going to have sustainable farming or sustainable land development or sustainable resource use, that we're going to have to do some structural change. And
right.
At least in 120 different communities across the United States at this point, that has meant passing laws that confront existing law.
Now, when those laws are passed, then the corporations sue against those laws, and then it gets into the federal court system, and I'm assuming the towns and communities end up getting slapped down.
Well, either the state or federal court system. But the unique thing about these ordinances is, number one, they're built on this innate sense and right of local community self-government, which is
right.
a big deal
right.
because it turns a battle between Walmart and the community or a fracking company and the community into one about rights.
Right.
And at least in the example of the city of Pittsburgh, where the gas corporations actually backed off. So think about how amazing this is. The city of Pittsburgh passed a community bill of rights that strips natural gas corporations of certain constitutional protections within the city. The natural gas corporations then pull back on their threat to sue and leave the city of Pittsburgh alone. Because when you change the battle into one about rights, sometimes you have different outcomes.
Well, but they've backed off for now.
Absolutely.
They've backed off for now. Would it be inaccurate to say that this concept of corporate rights that needs to be challenged on so many different levels, whether it's the political giving unlimited political contributions, corrupting our political system, to the right to frack, that all of these that while many of these are grounded in the Constitution in ways that we agree needs to be changed, that probably is not going to happen tomorrow morning. They are also virtually all grounded not in legislation passed by elected officials or signed by elected presidents, and in fact, in many cases, opposed by elected officials and elected presidents, are arguably the most famous Franklin Roosevelt in 1936 when he tried to take on the Supreme Court, but by the Supreme Court, which in 1803 gave itself the power to decide which laws were constitutional and which were not.
Sure, judicial review.
Right.
Although we do have to pull the covers a little bit back on Congress's actions regarding corporate personhood. There's a section of the definitions within the U.S. Code which include corporations as persons.
Right.
And, of course, for the last 100 years, whenever major pieces of legislation have been passed, they actually define corporations as persons as well.
Right. But that understanding is as artificial persons, not as natural persons.
In some cases, yes, and others, no. I mean, the fact is that the Supreme Court, starting with the Dartmouth College case, moving through Santa Clara, and then these 63 other cases which have declared that corporations are persons for some aspect of constitutional law, the fact is that those have set the grid, right, for everybody to work from. And so, as they're exercised, like, for example, Waste Management Corporation suing the state of Virginia to overturn an out-of-state waste ban that the state of Virginia passed in the 1990s, what happens now is that legislators don't even question the fact that they don't have the authority to pass, right, out-of-state waste bans.
Because the Supreme Court said so, which leads to my question. After Roe v. Wade, Phyllis Schlafly and others on the right got very active, and there was a very strong movement to try to say that judicial review is itself unconstitutional. It's a violation of Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution.
Sure.
There's no place in the Constitution where it says that this third among equal branch, that the court system has the right to strike down laws passed by the president or signed by the president, passed by Congress. And B, that right there in Section 3, Article 3, Section 2, it says that the Supreme Court shall operate within the constraints defined by Congress. And that's not the first time that there's been such a movement in the history of the United States. It's just the most recent and largest. And that was, you know, as I said, against Roe v. Wade. I've had Phyllis Schlafly on this program, and it's a really interesting history of what they did in the 70s and how they came up against this conventional wisdom in law schools that judicial review not only always was and always has been, and we know it's only been since 1803, but that it was the intent of the founders and, you know, quack, 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 and nobody's really going to seriously take it on. Do you think that that might be a lever?
I think it could be, but I would also be perhaps as heretical to say that it doesn't matter what we want at this point, or it doesn't matter what we think, because at this point we don't have the levers to move those things. Right. And I think until we develop an organizing strategy that's cohesive, right, that actually takes on not just corporate rights, but, you know, to mention another sacred cow is preemption. I mean, how democratic is it that corporations are able to use federal and state governments, essentially a smaller number of people located further away from the communities in which they're doing business, to actually put a straitjacket on local municipalities from passing anything more stringent than what the state or federal government has passed?
Right.
And building on that, there are some basic tenets of our constitutional system, like nature being property. I mean, that's how natures and ecosystems are treated under the system of law,
right,
which means that the more property you have, the more nature you can destroy. I mean, how democratic or sustainable is that?
How useful is that in this era?
Yeah, the issue is, how are we going to change these things if we think that they're the wrong things? And to date, the liberal progressive community has had a very poor record of actually engineering new organizing strategies and tactics. We tend to stick with the 60s mode of activism, which the corporate boys are not sticking with. They don't feel limited to that.
Right.
If they say, give us $10 million, we'll change a basic tenet of the law that is stopping us from moving forward to maximize our profit and wealth.
Right. Thomas, we're out of time, but in essence, get out there, get organized. Go to celdef.org, celdef.org. Thank you, Thomas.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And collaterally, movetoamend.org as well. The two organizations that are doing really significant work in this field. We'll be back.
Just moved in my new house today. Moving was hard, but I got squared away. Bells started ringing and chain ran loud. You had moved in a haunted house.
Welcome back, yeah. Speaking of haunted houses, imagine that if you are living in Transylvania, as the students at Zisky Gerkli High School in Western Romania's city of Arad were in the home of Vlad the Impaler. You come in to take your school exams, and what do you see? Bats hanging from the ceiling all over the room. No, it seriously really happened. So they took their exam in another room. I guess that's the punchline for the story. Anyhow, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, Dave in East Windsor, Connecticut. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Tom, I just wanted to add a little bit to the discussion you had with a previous caller who was trying to make a case for considering associations and chambers of commerce
as unions. And if you kind of follow my logic here,
sure.
Being a former teacher, I belong to the local teachers association, therefore belonging to the Connecticut Teachers Association, therefore belonging to the National Education Association.
Right.
Of course, you always hear the teachers of being in a union. You don't really hear about associations.
Right.
Some of my dues contributed, went up all the way up the ladder, and I'm sure contributed to some lobbying efforts on behalf of the National Education Association.
Sure.
Well, locally, you have businesses belong to the local Chamber of Commerce, who belong to the state Chamber of Commerce, who belong to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and they perform the same functions. And I think the fact that when we call teachers a union, it has a pejorative overtone to it. And I think if we started framing things and said business associations and chambers of commerce are also unions, then one of two things happens. Either the term union is going to lose its pejorative aura, or a worst-case scenario, you're going to start seeing the Chamber of Commerce and their activities viewed in a more pejorative light.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the Chamber of Commerce is by and large not so much funded by those local dues and those local folks as it is very, very large transnational corporations. It has become the lobbying arm and institution of, by and for, some very massive corporations and their own corporate interests. If you were to call it a union, and if you were to say, okay, if you want to do business in this community, you must join the chamber, just like in a workplace, if you want to be in that unionized workplace, you have to join the union, then that would give more credence to the notion that is promoted on the right that somehow unions are based in some kind of thuggery because you must participate. The fact of the matter is that, you know, in a union, everybody benefits from what the union is doing within the organization, within the workplace, whereas in a local community, you can join the chamber or not, and you may or may not benefit from anything that the chamber is doing. I really think that there's a apples and oranges distinction here. I understand your point about language.
By the same token, not every teacher is forced to join the local teachers association. So,
right.
As you say, not every business has to join the Chamber of Commerce. Not every teacher has to join the teachers association.
Doesn't that vary by state?
I don't know. I know that there are states where you have the option every year to join the association or not join.
I'm pretty sure that's what Taft-Hartley in 1947 was all about. The whole right to work for less was that individual states could choose to opt out of the provisions of the Wagner Act of 1935, the National Labor Relations Act, that set up a structure for unions, and that those right to work for less states became places where union membership was optional. Whereas in the states that chose not to go with the Wagner Act or with the Taft-Hartley, not to become right to work for less states, if your shop was union, you were a member of the union. I mean, you could choose to only pay part of the due. You know, there's variations in how much you could become a member of the union. But frankly, I can't say that for certain with regard to teachers. I don't know how that works.
I guess another example might be attorneys. Does every attorney have to be a member of be in the American Bar Association?
Well, they have to be. I'm not an attorney. I don't know the details of that. My understanding is that the Bar Association administers the exams. I don't know.
Right.
The AMA used to be the certifying body for doctors, and now only about 15% of doctors are members of the AMA. So I don't know.
We're kind of getting off the point that I think that woman was trying to make, and I'm trying to basically back her up. Is I think framing these things makes a big difference, and
right.
I think the fact that certain occupations in this country are framed as being union is a pejorative term to it, and other business ventures or other things are not framed as unions, where you could perhaps make an argument that they could be.
Right. I would say take back the pejorative. It used to be that to say I'm a liberal meant that you would be attacked. You know, in the late 80s, you know, when Reagan and Rush Limbaugh were at their peak, and you know, if somebody just came out, you know, people. Liberals said that it wouldn't say that they were liberals. They would say that they were Democrats, or they would say that, you know, well, I'm kind of moderate, or, you know, whatever. I mean, and we've taken that word back. I think taking the union back is a better thing than to try to say, oh, that that Chamber of Commerce, it's a union of by and for rich people. It is a lobbying agency, a lobbying organization of by and for rich people. It is a you know, an influence peddling organization of by and for rich people and corporations. And those words already are pejorative in their association. And so, but, you know, Dave will, let me think about it. I'm not drawing any lines in the sand here. Let me ponder your.
If I can get you to think about something, I feel like I've really done something. I love your show.
Okay.
And thanks a lot. Keep it going.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks a lot for calling. Francis in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Francis, what's on your mind today?
Tom. This is Francis Kane. I want to talk to you about why don't we just ignore the Supreme Court ruling, since Andrew Jackson ignored it and got away with it. And
now, back, you know, if you go back to Federalist 78, written by Alexander Hamilton, when they were trying to sell the Constitution to Americans, he pointed out in Federalist 78 that the Supreme Court has no enforcement mechanism. Therefore, they were the weakest of the three branches of government. That
right.
Congress could make laws, the president and the executive branch enforced the laws, but that there was no enforcement mechanism available to the judiciary without the consent of the executive branch. And so, you know, certainly there was in the minds of some of the founders. I'm not familiar with the Andrew Jackson example. You want to inform me? Tell us about that.
That was the Second National Bank.
Oh, okay.
Remember, he wanted to do away with the Second National Bank, and the Supreme Court said no. He said, well, you made your ruling, now enforce it. And they couldn't.
Right. And he put that bank out of business.
Right.
Yeah.
But he didn't like it, so he just ignored it.
Well, you know, yeah, that was the basis of his campaign. That's interesting. I'll have to dig more into that, Francis. If you have any good sources on that, I'd love to see.
Corporations, they want to be a human.
Right.
Well, if they're a human, a guy running it is a human.
Yeah.
So he has to be. Somebody has to be the caretaker. You're just like a baby. A baby has to have a caretaker. So why can't the caretaker be the guy in charge?
Yeah, well, you know, arguably it is, where it's the board of directors, but, you know, they have all these,
like a human.
They have all these immunities. I mean, it's just a very odd and strange thing. You know, the other way to do it is the Constitution doesn't define how many members of the Supreme Court there are. And, you know, when we started out, there were six, and we've been as high as 10.
Right. 11.
Right. Roosevelt wanted to do was say that at that time there were nine. I mean, there are nine now. He wanted to say anybody over the age of 70 would become a member emeritus and lose his right to vote. And another person would have one right to vote. But as many members over 70 as there were, in aggregate, they would all have one vote. And so you would have to add new members to the court to make up for those people. Now, at that time in 1936, I think that there were like five members of the court who were over 70 years old. So basically he would have, you know, added another five or, yeah, whatever it was, four or five members of the court. It would have ended up around 13 to make up for that. And, you know, of course, it blew up in his face. It's actually, we had an interesting conversation with the guy who wrote literally the book on that a week or so ago. I read the book, and Roosevelt may well have gotten away with it if he had played it a little differently. He politically kind of screwed it up. But, you know, the whole issue of how do you get around the Supreme Court is an interesting one. The problem, as Tom Lindsay points out, is there is going to be no getting around the Supreme Court by a president or by a legislature if there's not such a powerful citizens movement that president and that legislature feel that they have no choice but to do that. And
well,
that's,
I agree with you there, but
yeah.
I just don't understand why they just can't do some of that kind of stuff.
Roosevelt tried and it almost ended his presidency. I think that the idea that communities have rights, individuals have rights, is a highly contagious idea. And the Tom Lindsay and the folks at CELDF, CELDF.org, are really doing it right. Check them out.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour, more of your calls, and we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service to find out what's going on in the world.
Never come with a warning. A revolution never sends you an omen. A revolution just arrived like the morning. Ring the alarm, we come to wake up the snoring. They're telling
you. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, and Victoria Jones of the Talk Ready News Service, TalkReadyNews.com, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, they're back.
They are. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I noticed the city seemed a little fuller this morning, although the cab driver, I ended up taking a taxi. I usually walk, but a whole long story. In any case, he said, the town doesn't seem as full as it usually is. I don't know why. Is it that the lobbyists have decided to take an extra day off?
They may have done, because actually they're going to be suffering a little bit with the super committee because they may not get quite as much work. But it's actually officially known as Terrible Traffic Tuesday.
Oh, really?
Yes, because everybody's back and it's just terrible. And, of course, the escalators are out on the metro and it's all a nightmare. But the Senate convenes at 2 p.m. Eastern. And the House had a little pro forma session when it didn't do very much, probably named a post office. Not that there are going to be many of them left, but we'll get to that. Mm-hmm. And then it comes back tomorrow. But the Senate comes back with a roar.
Okay.
Senate Banking Committee will have a hearing today on President Obama's controversial nominee to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Richard Cordray, former Ohio Attorney General and current enforcer at the Consumer Financial Protection
Bureau. And he's controversial because?
He's controversial because, well, he's not the number one choice. That, of course, would have been Harvard Professor Elizabeth Warren. He's controversial because he's a human being.
Oh, and he was nominated by a Democratic president.
By a Democratic president, and because the vast majority of Republican senators signed a letter saying that they objected to anyone becoming director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Oh, so literally, it's because he's a human being. If
correct.
If they had a R2-D2, if they had a robot.
Yes.
Okay.
But
all right.
They want a number of changes to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that the president objects to, which he says would gut it. And they want a number of changes to the role of director, which he says would defang him. And so right. Basically, it's going to be very difficult for Richard Cordray to become confirmed, very difficult for him to get 60 votes. But he's going to give it the old college try. He's going to make a number of points in his remarks today. He's going to say that as Ohio State Treasurer, he expanded a low-interest loan program and fought to make it available to community banks. He's saying that because Republicans are saying that the Dodd-Frank law, which created the CFPB, has requirements that will hurt community banks. He's also going to make the argument, and it's fascinating that he makes this argument, that enforcing financial honesty helps legitimate businesses.
You know, this is the thing that boggles my mind, Victoria. George W. Bush basically ran on a platform of reducing regulation, which he did with the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, or whatever he called them, Clear Skies Initiative, cutting regulations on businesses, cutting taxes on rich people, and reducing the size of government. Now, with regard to reducing the size of government, you know, two wars didn't pull that off. But basically, he did those things. And now Republicans are saying, we want to do the exact same thing that George Bush campaigned on and did, and that's going to bring us prosperity. I don't get it.
Well, there's a very interesting piece by Ezra Klein, actually, the Washington Post columnist,
sure,
about this, sort of saying, why is it that Republicans are saying that? Why is it that they're anti-stimulus? Why is it that they're anti-things that 5 years, 10 years ago? And he quotes
Paul Ryan. He quotes people who were in favor of these things 10, 15 years ago, that they've now gone against them, and he doesn't come up with an answer except basically at the end of his article he says, ask a psychologist, because he can't come up with a fiscal reason why they have turned against policies that they were for.
Well, you don't have to ask a psychologist. You have to ask Jude Winiski. He laid this out back in 1976 with his two Santa Claus theory proposal to the Republican Party that they have been following ever since, where when, you know, his argument was that the Democrats always got to be Santa Claus by, you know, union rights and unemployment benefits and Social Security and things. So when Republicans got into power, they could become Santa Clauses by huge tax cuts and lots of spending and make everybody feel good. And then, of course, that would run up huge deficits. So as soon as Democrats came into power, the Republicans just started screaming about deficits like they're the most important thing in the world and forced the Democrats to cut the programs that they themselves had put into place, depriving them of the ability to be Santa Claus. And letting the Republicans continue to play the role of Santa Claus, basically flipping politics upside down. And it was put into place by Reagan, and they've been doing it ever since. Every time you got a Republican president, they borrow like crazy and they spend like crazy. Every time you get a Democrat in the White House, Bill Clinton, a case in point, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, the Republicans scream about debt and deficits and that's it. And taxes.
That's so. Very interesting. I did not know that. That's fascinating.
Oh, really?
Fascinating.
Google two Santa Claus theory and my name, and you'll find an article I wrote about this almost 10 years ago, I think, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, actually quoting from Jude Winiski's original memo, his articles about it. The way I learned about it, actually, was in 2002 or 2003. I was reading an article in the Wall Street Journal about how successful the Republicans were in executing Jude Winiski's theory. This was basically they were bragging to themselves because George W. Bush was borrowing like crazy and spending like crazy, and not a single Republican was raising a peep. And, you know, just wait until a Democrat gets into office, all hell will break loose, because this is the strategy that Winiski laid out back in 76, and they've been following it with great discipline.
Well, this takes us very nicely to the president's job speech on Thursday, in which he will make a number of proposals which will go absolutely nowhere because Republicans will knock them all down.
Yeah, and knock them all down or simply refuse to consider them, right?
That's correct. Yes, yeah. Refuse to consider them, even though some of them are proposals like the payroll tax cut for workers, which they have, in fact, supported in the past.
Well, in fact, the Republicans originally proposed it. So, anyway, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Ari Berman on the line with us with Rolling Stone. He is a contributor to Rolling Stone magazine, the political correspondent for The Nation magazine as well, and the author of Herding Donkeys. But his most recent piece in Rolling Stone, rollingstone.com, The GOP War on Voting, is particularly fascinating. Ari, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you with us. The story that many Americans have been hearing for some years now, mostly out of Fox News, but largely echoing through the whole media sphere, is that there has been enormous voting fraud going on, that illegal immigrants, in particular Hispanics, are showing up in large numbers at the polls to vote, that poor people are voting 2, 3, 5, 10, 12 times, dead people are showing up to vote, that this is a crisis of biblical proportions in the United States that threatens democracy itself, that there was this giant criminal conspiracy around it run largely by African Americans called ACORN, and that it has finally, successfully been excised, this cancer, from our body politic, but we have to take the next step to prevent any of this kind of horror from ever happening again. Have I characterized the the narrative, the setup narrative accurately.
Yeah, that's basically the setup narrative, which, of course, as I'm sure we'll talk about, is a total lie. The fact is that Republicans have been talking about this boogeyman of voter fraud for a while, and it intensified after the election of Barack Obama, which many conservatives viewed as stolen by Acorn, and that laid the groundwork for this unprecedented push to rewrite the nation's election laws in advance of the 2012 election, and really tried to suppress a number of Democratic-leaning voters, the very voters that gave Barack Obama his majority in 2008, from voting again for Obama in 2012. And the thing about vote fraud is in-person voter impersonation, which is what these laws are designed to crack down on, doesn't really exist. There is a great study by the Brennan Center that found that a voter is more likely to be hit by lightning than they are to impersonate another voter.
Well,
at
in polls. In fact, I understand that about 700 people a year in America are hit by lightning, and about 20 people a year in America are actually charged with voting illegally.
Well, the Justice Department during the Bush administration made prosecuting voter fraud a top priority. And between 2002 and 2007, when 300 million people voted, they prosecuted only 86 cases of voter fraud. And most of those were cases where people didn't even realize they were ineligible to vote. And so it wasn't even part of any sort of conspiracy, even those few 86 instances they found. So this is really an incredibly draconian solution to a problem that doesn't exist.
Right. More people die from, you know, drinking too much water or something. That's not the right example. But, you know, being struck by lightning is certainly a good one. And so the Republicans have sold this idea of, I think, quite successfully to their own base, and even with some success to people who are politically naive or not particularly well informed. And they're using that sales job now to pass laws to protect us from these horrors of 20 people a year voting when they're ineligible to. They're not in the right state, or they're not a resident, or they were a felon and they didn't know that they couldn't be vote when they were a felon, or whatever it may be. Or people like Ann Coulter, who registered to vote at her agent's house because she didn't want her own home address to be a matter of public record. Or maybe Mitt Romney, who is registered to vote in his son's unfinished basement in Massachusetts but lives in a mansion in California. To the best of my knowledge, neither of those have been prosecuted for voter fraud. But in any case, now the Republicans are offering us a solution.
Well, these 20 cases of voter fraud, as you mentioned, have really justified a crackdown and a wholesale rewriting of the election laws that could prevent millions of people from voting. And they're doing that by making it harder to register to vote, making it harder for groups to register people to vote, cutting back on early voting, requiring these photo IDs that 10% of U.S. citizens, including 18% of young people and 25% of African Americans, don't have, writing the laws so that people who have IDs, for example, students and African Americans, won't be able to vote because the IDs they have are considered ineligible. States like Texas saying you can't have a student ID, but you can have a gun permit. And then preventing ex-felons who have served their time from voting in states like Florida and Iowa, just instantly disenfranchising hundreds of thousands of voters. So you have this situation where it all adds up. These seemingly disconnected measures all add up to this really sweeping attempt to rig the electorate for the 2012 election. And E.J. Dionne wrote a while back in a Washington Post column, if this were happening in a quote-unquote emerging democracy, we would condemn it as election rigging, but that's exactly right. What's going on here right now since the 2010 election by the GOP.
Well, you know, keep in mind, Ari, this is the country where a presidential election was decided in the state of the brother of the guy running for president in 2000 on the Supreme Court, where there were members of the Supreme Court who had several members whose family members were working for directly or peripherally the campaign of the guy that won. I mean, it's not like we haven't had third world politics for some time in this country.
Well, that's what I say in the article, that it's incredibly ironic that the party that won the 2000 election despite having lost the popular vote is now on this rampage about voter fraud. Because if anyone won an election illegitimately, it was George W. Bush in 2000, not Barack Obama
in
2008.
But that's the point. I mean, they Catherine Harris successfully knocked 60 to 80,000 African Americans off the voter polls, off the eligibility polls in Florida by claiming that they were felons when in fact they weren't. They just had names that were similar to Texas felons, common African-American names. And that worked. I mean, that got them within the margin of error where if they could stop the actual statewide count, they could declare George Bush the winner, which they did, and, you know, basically steal the election. So now, rather than knocking 80,000 off, let's knock 180,000 off so there won't even be any question.
Yeah, absolutely. And these changes are happening in battleground states like Ohio, like Florida, like Wisconsin, that are going to be very close in 2012, and everyone knows it. And what Republicans are trying to ensure is basically to secure their own reelection before anyone's voted. So it doesn't matter if the economy improves. It doesn't matter if Barack Obama does better in the polls. It doesn't matter if it's Michelle Bachmann, Rick Perry, or Mitt Romney. They want this electorate in place. And right. Bill Clinton has said this is not rocket science. They want the 2012 election to look more like 2010 than 2008. And they're writing the rules in such a way to ensure that that's the electorate that turns out.
Yeah, between that and redistricting. You know, it's the old Joe Stalin. You know, I don't care how people vote. I just care who counts the votes.
and that's why this is distressing for me for a small D Democratic reason. I mean, you don't have to be a Republican. You don't have to be a Democrat. The fact that we're making it so much more difficult for people to vote is what's really
Ari, we have 30 seconds left. What can people do about this? Ari Berman.
Sure. Well, they first have to get educated, go to Rock the Vote, go to the Brennan Center, go to all the League of Women Voters, all those different groups that are doing this work, find out whether they have the right ID, find out what it takes to get the right ID. You first have to be aware of this issue before you can do anything about it. And that's one of the reasons we wrote this article now, to try to get it out there, but before people realize that they can't vote in the next election.
Because there's going to be a whole lot of people who are going to show up in November 2012 and be sent away, basically.
And hopefully that doesn't
happen. Or be given placebo ballots.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And hopefully that doesn't happen because people will be aware of it beforehand and can actually do something proactive.
Right. What
about
the Justice Department striking this stuff down as an extension of the Jim Crow laws?
They could do that. The Justice Department has to review all the states that are under the purview of the Voting Rights Act. They're in the process of doing that right now. They haven't been too aggressive recently, but there are signs that they're looking at this stuff very closely. So that's another recourse for people. And there's going to be a number of lawsuits in states like Missouri, Florida, Wisconsin, etc. So this stuff's still moving through the courts as well.
Great. Ari Berman, you can read all about it over at rollingstone.com, the GOP war on voting. In a campaign supported by the Koch brothers, Republicans working to prevent millions of Democrats from voting next year. Thanks, Ari.
Thanks, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. So, all the more reason for us to get out there and get active now.
I mean, I have the right to vote, so I have a say. But that doesn't mean I always get my way.
Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Alice in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Alice, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I want to go back to what you were explaining earlier about the Susie United, the right to speak and the right to hear.
Right.
And I wasn't sure if I misunderstood. Would anonymous campaign donations by corporations be excluded from the right to speak?
In the way that Citizens United was framed, and let me encourage you again to actually read the decision. You can find it online quite easily. The way that that decision was framed was that you, Alice, and I have the right to hear all points of view on important issues, particularly those that might involve politics. And that large corporations and wealthy people are major actors in those issues. And so we have an absolute right to hear what they have to say. And nothing should impede our right to hear what they have to say, meaning laws like McCain-Feingold, which said that they were limited to a certain number of dollars that they could spend, or they could only spend money in certain ways for certain candidacies or campaigns, or they had to run their money through through political action committees that had to have certain transparency requirements. All of those things were interferences on their on our right to hear what they had to say. And that's the way that Citizens United is constructed. It doesn't explicitly come right out and say, oh, you know, corporations are people, and although it does, but it doesn't assert. And in fact, in this year, when Scalia made his from the bench made his sarcastic comment in the AT&T case, none of us are suggesting that corporations are the same thing as people. You know, it doesn't. You know, Citizens United isn't saying explicitly that corporations are fully human people. It's saying that as artificial persons, they participate in the political dialogue, and that because we have the right to hear them, they inherit the right from us to tell us. Does that make sense?
So I can't read into it that the violation of a transparency requirement would not include anonymous campaign donations.
I am with you. And in fact, when you read the dissent in Citizens United, which was largely written by Justice Stevens, it is brilliant, and it calls out the illogic of the argument of the case. It calls out the consequences of the case. It points out how fundamentally un-American this case is. Justice Stevens, in his dissent, even goes so far as to say, you know, under this logic, Tokyo Rose during World War II would have had every right to speak to every soldier in the American military because they had the right to hear her. Et cetera. So that's the construction of it, if that makes sense. Have I answered your question?
I think you have. It still smells of a rigged game.
It is a rigged game.
It
is a rigged game.
I need to listen to you and your guests. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much, Alice. Here's the bottom line. The Supreme Court has been defending the interests of the rich and the powerful since 1803. I mean, you know, it has that's been basically the Supreme Court's function. There have been times when they've backed off a little bit. You know, in 1961, I forget the name of the decision, but it was the case where evidence obtained illegally could not be used in a court of law. That, you know, infuriated a lot of people in 1965, I believe it was. You had the Miranda decision that said that people had to be told their rights. Now the Supreme Court has backed off on that in the last year. But generally, basically, the court's there for the rich and the powerful. Bob in Farmington, Missouri. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Well, you've been talking to people about the problem and trying to solve it. And I think I know what will happen if we don't. If you look at the political tactics the Republican Party's used, if you look at what they did the last time they were in power, I think you can kind of extrapolate from that. I think all this is going to happen at once, and I think they'll be very aggressive about it. I think they'll move to keep power. They'll move to consolidate control of the media. There'll be voter suppression laws that'll make what we've got now look funny. There'll be more scapegoats. There'll be more fear. They'll move to take all the wealth, all the resources they can. They'll try to take away our rights. They'll take away our unions, our Social Security.
It's already underway. It's already underway. You know, Russell Kirk in 1953, in his book The Conservative Mind, his 10 tenets of conservatism, one of them is that conservatives realize that humans are more motivated by emotion than by logic. And I believe that, you know, to a certain extent he's right, and that and conservatives have certainly use that and said, okay, and the emotion that we choose to use is fear. I mean, look at this entire industry that has grown up around be afraid, be very afraid. More people are killed by lightning than, you know, the 700 people a year that we mentioned earlier than commit voting fraud. Well, more people are killed by lightning in the United States than are killed by terrorists, too. And, you know, yet look at what you've got to go through to get on an airplane.
They'll take everything away from us. We've got to remember that the Republican Party is run by some radical right-wing billionaires, and all they care about is profits. They don't care about the people. They don't care about the country. They don't even care about democracy.
Right.
People think they want to turn the time back to some former time in this country. I don't think so. I think they want a different form of government, and they're going to cause crises, and then they're going to promise this job.
Yeah. I don't disagree with you, Bob, and I would tell you that there is a name for that former that type of government that they want, and it's called feudalism, F-E-U-D-A-L-I-S-M, where the people are basically the property of the wealthy, and the state is the institution that enforces that. Bob, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and your call. 7 minutes past. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very asymmetrically ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for your brain. The good. Janet Napolitano, the Homeland Security Secretary, said that some airport security changes could be coming down the pike soon. In an interview with Politico, Napolitano said, quote, "We are moving towards an intelligence and risk-based approach to how we screen. I think one of the first things you will see over time is the ability to keep your shoes on," end quote. Wow. You mean we're actually going to start rolling back the security theater trappings that give us constant headaches at the airport? Let's hope Secretary Napolitano follows through with this and that we eventually dump the Chertoff x-ray porno scanners, too. By the way, most European countries don't make you take your shoes off. The bad. Fox so-called news. The mouthpiece of the Republican Party is trying to manufacture a controversy around tomorrow's Republican debate hosted by their rival NBC, citing that a number of Republicans were not invited to attend the debate, like Congressman Thaddeus McConnor, Buddy Romer, and Gary Johnson, people you probably never heard of. Talking head Neil Cavuto said, "I think the real scandal is who won't be in that particular debate, so I'm calling this podium gate. Why not just add more podiums for legit candidates? How can groundbreaking ideas ever get through if we don't let the guys in offering them break them?" How noble of Neil Cavuto, looking out for the forgotten Republican candidates. Unfortunately, he didn't have a problem last month when his own Fox so-called News hosted a Republican debate and excluded those very same candidates from participating. Fox so-called News, your number one source for blatant hypocrisy. And the very, very ugly Dick Cheney. The War Criminals book tour continued this weekend, and the man without a pulse showed up on Fox News Sunday morning to promote his rewrite of American history. When pressed on whether or not he's worried about being tried as a war criminal, as Colin Powell's former chief of staff Lawrence Wilkerson alleged, Cheney laughed it off, calling it a cheap shot. That's right, Dick Cheney laughed off war crimes. He laughed off torturing people and lying this nation into a war that is still raging today, the longest in American history. It's as though Cheney is trying to outdo himself when it comes to how evil someone can be. And that's very, very ugly. And pretty amazing, actually, when you think about it. It's, oh, incredible. It's just incredible. Mike in Columbia, Missouri. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. Your previous caller, Robert from Farmington, Missouri.
Also from Missouri.
Yeah. I think he may have answered what I want to ask you, but I want to ask your opinion. What do you really think will happen to this country if we get one of these crazy Republicans as president and the Congress goes Republican in both houses?
I think a lot of it, frankly, is going to depend on external circumstances. What we saw when Reagan became president, when Bush, the elder Bush became president, was that the Republicans embraced Keynesian economics. They embraced stimulus. They did so in ways that were reckless and irresponsible. They enriched their war contractor buddies rather than the people. But they weren't totally off the rails. They were just partly off the rails. And they set up the destruction of the middle class. When George W. Bush came into office, he went totally off the rails, you know, with war and torture and all those kind of things. And whether that was the result of him and Dick Cheney having PTSD from 9/11, or whether they were nuts to begin with, or whether they are, you know, simply anomalies in American history, and war criminals, I'm not sure. I frankly, my sense of it is that a true right-wing George W. Bush crazy probably could not win a general election. And so Rick Perry either has to be majorly reinvented or he doesn't have a chance against Barack Obama. And Michelle Bachmann is already imploding, and her campaign is going down in flames. 80% of Republicans don't want Sarah Palin to run for president, and she won't, frankly. She's got too good a gig going as it is, and she's making too much money. So, and she just isn't into that governing thing. You know, she quit halfway through her four-year term as governor of Alaska. So if Mitt Romney ends up being the Republican presidential candidate and there's some sanity in the Republicans in the House and Senate, which there may well be after the next election, my sense of it, and I realize this may put me at odds with many of my contemporaries, is that it's going to be bad for this country. It's going to be particularly bad for working people in this country, but it's not going to be the end of America as we know it or the destruction. It's just going to continue us down the road that Reagan and the first Bush put us on. On the other hand, I think that if President Obama is elected and there is a large Democratic majority in the House and Senate, which we are, you know, have to hope and pray for and do everything we can to work for, I think it's entirely possible that we could actually reverse the Reagan Revolution, which is what Romney would simply continue, and give working people in America back their rights and bring manufacturing back to this country and have, you know, regulatory systems that actually work so we don't have imploding banks and you know, poisonous products and et cetera. So, but on the other hand, I prefaced all this by saying it depends on what happens. If between now and the election, or even after the election, regardless of which candidate is elected, if there is a major terrorist incident, if there is a major, Fukushima kind of event here, anything like that, all bets are off. You know, disaster capitalism has been demonstrated. You know, Naomi Klein named it, and she is so right. And they have been doing this so well that, you know, they're just salivating at the opportunity to take over the infrastructure of this country and take it. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, Mitt Romney. I'm amazed at how greedy he is. And President Obama, this is so unfortunate. I think he's so weak at executing. He's in the executive branch. He's just not doing it. I don't know if somebody's got him by his hands tied behind his back or something, but he's not doing what. Like
well,
when he campaigned.
What he did during the first couple of years, first of all, a lot got done during the first couple of years of his presidency for which he doesn't get credit and which he's starting to now claim credit for in the speech that he gave on Friday, for example. And, you know, he pointed out the largest middle tax class cut in history, a stimulus that actually, you know, 14, 15 months now, maybe 16 or 17 of straight months of private sector job creation. Took us out of a Great Depression, and now we're merely in a bad recession. More kids have health care. Health insurance companies can't screw you. Starting in the first of the year, what you're going to start seeing is your health insurance premiums are either going to go down or your benefit packages are going to go up because the health insurance companies, because of the Obamacare law, are required now by law to spend 80% of what they take in on actually providing care. Already they're starting, you know, this has stopped or slowed down the growth of prices. There's a lot of good stuff that he has done. He hasn't, in my opinion, been particularly, hasn't used the bully pulpit as well as he could have or should have, but I think he's learning that lesson. And, I believe that, you know, a second term of his would be actually a productive thing in this country. But you're to the larger point of who's really in charge. I think that the issue of corporate power in this country is one that has to be addressed, and it's not going to be addressed between now and the election, I promise, because of Citizens United. But after the election, that's going to be, I think, the biggest difference. If we end up with a Romney who made his fortune, you know, building corporate institutions and corporate power versus a Barack Obama who built his career on helping those who were the victims of corporate power, we could see America go in one of two very, very different directions. So we'll see. We'll have to see how it shakes out. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Joe in Alachua, Florida. Do I am I pronouncing it right, Joe?
Yes, sir. It's Alachua, Florida, just north of Gainesville.
Okay.
Tom, I love your show. I've got my satellite program to it every day to automatically come on to it. And I cannot believe that this is the first time I even dialed you, and I got through.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
I wanted to make a comment about that gentleman who earlier had talked about suppression of the vote. This is something I'm very aware of. Coming from the state of Florida, let's remember the 2000 election. And you mentioned that the way things are going, this could be just like the Middle Ages feudalism.
Yeah.
Now, if this should happen, people are turned away from the polls. People's rights are taken from them. And I believe, too, that the Tea Party is going to get eaten up by this just as well as everyone else. They don't realize.
Well, I think the Tea Party is vanishing right in front of your eyes. There was a big Tea Party rally in St. Louis 2 weekends ago, and 3 people showed up. I mean, people have figured it out. The Tea Party is now just the fat cats and the institutions and a few people who are groupies of rock stars like Sarah Palin.
Well, you see now when they have these rallies, even the one on Saturday, they said they had 2,000 people, but I doubt if there were even that many because I listened to it for as much as I could take, and didn't want to hear Sarah Palin. That screeching voice just drives me crazy. But when the other speakers were on there and then they were applauding, it did not sound like 2,000 people there.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I can't verify that. But my point is, the bottom line is this. If we get to the point where we lose these rights, we lose all our entitlements, we lose all the things that we have worked for so throughout the labor movement, my father was a member of that. He was a union rep. Then what are we going to do? Is there going to be rioting in the streets?
I think it's possible.
Is this going to turn?
I think it's possible.
I don't want to say Nazi Germany.
No, I don't think we're going to go down that road. But you're seeing it in the United Kingdom right now. You're seeing it in Israel right now. 400,000 people in the streets, mostly young people, protesting high rent and low wages. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me at all to see that sort of thing in the United States. Time will tell, Joe.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your thoughts and mine right after this. 45 minutes past.
From the war against disorder.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Alan in Plymouth, or Alex, rather, in Plymouth, Michigan. Hey, Alex, what's up?
I just want to talk about me attending the Detroit Labor Day parade yesterday.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, I'm with a group called AutoWorkerCaravan.org, and we want to bring to people's attention the two-tier wage schemes that are now prevalent within the big three UAW-represented auto plants.
Right.
Basically, what you're seeing more and more is people getting hired in on the second tier, which is basically $14.50 an hour with very little benefits, and they're staying at that wage. And if this continues, we're going to have a problem because you can't have full employment with half wages.
Right, I agree. And in the first hour of our program, I talked about this at some length with James Hoffa, the president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, and I'm of the opinion that the essence of the Reagan Revolution was that it reversed the essence of the New Deal. The New Deal was if you graduate from high school, keep your nose clean. Work hard, you're a decent citizen, then you can have the American dream. You can buy a house, have a car, take a vacation, have decent retirement, put your kids through school, just the basic core stuff. You can have a middle-class life. And what the Reagan Revolution did was to say, you're not entitled to that stuff anymore. We're going to change the social contract. Government is no longer going to enforce rules that will require business to make those kinds of things available to workers. And it has happened gradually over a 30-year period, but now we're starting to see it being nakedly done. We're seeing it nakedly done with Eric Cantor and Paul Ryan and John Boehner pushing through the House of Representatives a law that privatizes Medicare, that does away with Medicare as we know it and turns it into a voucher system. We're seeing it nakedly done in the two- and three-tier pay systems that are happening not just in the auto industry. They're also happening in the high-tech industry with engineers, where engineers that were hired 10 years ago are making $130,000, and new people being hired in are being hired in at $40,000 and $50,000 a year. You're seeing it industry after industry after industry. I've seen it in the radio industry, where people who had been, you know, program directors in major stations and, you know, for years and years and years, and they were making, you know, 60, 80, 100 grand a year, they've been replaced by people who are relatively new into the field, and they're making 25, 30, 35 a year. It's like there's this whole new normal that has come about in America. And it is the result of the Reagan Revolution, of the rewriting of the social contract in America. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, Tom. But my problem is who's promoting it? I applaud James B. Hoffa for his stance.
Yeah.
But my problem is that my international union president, Bob King, is part of the problem. He's promoting these two-tier wage schemes to become competitive.
Well, and when you're confronted with a two-tier wage versus no wages, what's your choice?
That, obviously, we know the answer. But yeah. The union's job is to build a better life through increasing wages and working conditions.
Right.
Now, if we play the company's game, let's say we did that in the 1930s, we would never got to a livable wage that we have now.
But see, the difference was that in the 1930s, a company could not take their manufacturing offshore, because we had, you know, you had a 35% import tariff, it didn't happen. It wasn't possible. Now they can. In the 1930s, after 1935, you know, until 1947 with Taft-Hartley, in 1935, you couldn't break a strike. You couldn't bust a union. And so the power of unions.
In the 30s, it was illegal to have a strike at one time.
Up until 35, right.
That's right. We changed the game. It's time for us to change the game back.
Right. But the point that I'm making is that, if I may just very quickly, and then you can have the rest of the show to push back. We just have a couple of minutes. But the point that I'm making is that I think that Rich Trumka, who is saying, we're going to stop, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but essentially my take on what he's saying is, we're going to stop, you know, being about a party or about politicians, and instead we're going to be about, you know, having trade policies, about issues, changing the rules of the game, of trade, the rules of the game of labor, so that it's possible to have an environment in which a two-tiered structure isn't necessary. It, you know, isn't a club that an employer can use. And you know, I think playing at that bigger level of game is where labor needs to be. And the problem is the local unions and the smaller unions don't even have that option.
Yep.
Does that make sense?
The point I would like to make, and I want to thank you for listening to me, is the fact that the UAW president has promoted the CORUS, Korean Free Trade Agreement, to the consternation of people like James P. Hoffa and Leo Girard.
Yep.
And, you know, he just doesn't get it. And I think we should be able to do more than one thing at one time.
Yeah.
We should be able to walk and chew gum, and we should fight on both levels.
I agree with you. And I also agree, you know, I don't know the position of each individual union leader with regard to the free trade agreements, but I know many of them are opposed to them. I know James Hoffa certainly is opposed to them. He not only wrote an op-ed about it, but he cited my book, Rebooting the American Dream, in his op-ed a couple of months ago in Huffington Post. You know, tip of the hat to him for that. My chapter on the insanity of free trade. There are others who are saying the same thing, and I think saying so very wisely. That's the problem. It's like, you know, I've said for a long time, Walmart isn't evil in and of itself. They have been able to get the laws changed so that the way that they behave is destructive. We need to change the laws. We need to get control of the institutions of power in this country, which means political action. Alex, thank you for the call. And political action through our unions. And working within our unions to get the kind of leadership that's going to do the kind of things that are absolutely necessary. So don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate, when you get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.